Okay. How was that? What did you experience? Right there?
I had a strange, we were talking about compassion, about having compassion for yourself, and I kept seeing myself at the street corner, dark street corner, and I kept trying to get away from it to listen to my breath, and darting back and forth between the idea of, you know, let those thoughts ride and go back to your breath. Then I decided to stop at the street corner and see what the street corner was, and it was, you know, fourth grade, which I remember standing on the street corner.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Sometimes just meditating allows things to bubble up, kind of swamp gas, you know? Or when we're investigating, we turn over rocks and every so often something kind of creepy crawls out. And I think sometimes the art of practice that I personally am okay with in certain frames is to drop the method we're using and investigate the psychological material. But you know, one does so at one's peril. I mean, you have to be a little careful about it. There are two places to err. You know, we can err on the side of spiritual bypass, right? We can avoid dealing with material. And on the other hand, we can get excessively caught up in it. But I'll say this personally, I've had experiences while meditating where I'll have insight into some afflictive factor in my own mind, you know, that leads to grasping or aversion or doubt, right? One of the hindrances, let's say. And I find that's very valuable. And I look to see what's the result. When I enter it for a few minutes, often that's all it takes, then you go back, your mind's clearer, and you're dropped into a deeper place. So be careful about that method, but sometimes I think it's okay. Okay. How's the temp? We probably want it cooler, maybe? Some magic coolness? Yeah, right there.
What would you suggest,
no?
Recommend?
Not cooler? I was just roasting up here, and you're freezing. I got it now. I don't mind. I'll be like a lizard. I have a lot of affinity for lizards. I do, actually. I don't know why, but I do. Okay.
What often comes when I get quieted down are visual images, very often the outdoors someplace.
Uh-huh.
And this was a river in the woods in wintertime,
yeah.
Leaves on the trees.
Uh-huh.
And I tried to gently bat it away, and but then it came back again. So what would be your recommendation?
So her comment is kind of parallel. In other words, something in her case came up that felt very benign and very drawing and very persistent, an image of a river moving through the woods. And again, it has to do with the aim. If the aim is to steady the mind, one way to do it, frankly, is to rest it on something fairly unstimulating, like the breath. And maybe a river going through the woods is, you know, fairly stimulating, and it'll be a nice thing. You'll get a certain kind of meditative experience from it, relaxation, happiness, love of nature, maybe some insight into your own psychology, but it won't necessarily steady the mind in the way that a kind of muscular effort could. So that said, sometimes what people do is they will shift awareness to, they'll make the new object of attention something different, like, for example, a pleasurable sensation or an image. Technically, in certain kinds of practice, especially jhana practice, as you go on, people get what's called a nimitta, or a kind of circle or square, if you will, just a color, and then they're there. Or as you progress in it, sometimes it makes sense to shift attention away from the breath to the bliss, and make the bliss the object of attention, the rapture. So it's all about skillful means. I should add something I should have said before, because I got a little internally distracted. Remember I said there are two kinds of ways of looking at jhanas? One way is one in which there's no experience of the sensory world. That's not the way the Buddha described it. Maybe there's, in the Pali Canon at least, maybe there's some kind of coded language that he was using. But his description of the jhanas, if you remember from your last slide, is very specific. This is it. This is the recurring language you see again and again and again, sometimes minor variations. And this is a way of describing the jhanas in which there may well be awareness of the surround. Like in my own personal experience, when I've dropped into the first several jhanas at different times on retreat and at home once after retreat, you know, I could hear doors opening and closing, but I can definitely tell you I was no longer in Kansas. You know, when you're in those jhanas, it's a little bit like my grandfather told me that when I went fishing for the first time, you know, I was like 8 or something, Long Beach Bay, bobbing up and down. My grandfather said, "How will I know there's a fish on the other end of the line?" He said, "You'll know. It'll be like nothing you've ever felt before." And when there's that tipping into something so different and coherent and absorbing and full that has those attributes, you know, if it looks like a dog, walks like a dog, waves like a dog, could be a dog. Okay. So in any case, I want to talk a little bit, maybe hear from a couple more people, what is going on inside your brain when you're doing these first two of the five jhana factors, applied and sustained attention. So anybody else, in terms of an experience, how did they help? I guess that's the bottom line. How's it working for you? Question, right? Did doing those little methods, just exploring a lot of little different methods, did that help you get to more steadiness of mind maybe than you might ordinarily get to? I mean, I hope they did. Shakes and nods. So we have diversity. Okay, first you, and then behind you. Yeah, you.
Ah. And I've also noticed that with regard to physical exercise recently, where, you know, you're supposed to exercise to decrease stress, but when I exercise and I get, you know, a good aerobic workout, at the end I'm shaking.
Thank you for saying that. I think we all heard you. I would just comment first, both are normal in the sense, on the one case, when the mind quiets, oftentimes we become more aware of what's going on. In other words, the stars are always out, but we don't see them when the sun's up. But when the sun goes away, which is to say our normal busy mind, we see what's always been there, like an underlying kind of fear. And then sometimes there's a fear of quiet or a fear of inward looking, you know, because that's when things can really happen. So then you can help yourself work with that over time by both intervening out here in the environment, maybe in the body, you know, in terms of systems like serotonin that help people calm down, not necessarily with meds. Quick sidebar, to build serotonin, you take tryptophan, add some iron, then add some vitamin B6, you get serotonin. Serotonin is the neurotransmitter involved in positive mood as well as sleep and digestion. And so one way that's research established to improve serotonin levels and positive mood as a result, and also more resilience in the face of stress, is if there is a deficit in tryptophan coming in, or iron, a lot of women are subclinically anemic, or vitamin B6, if you supplement those things, studies have shown you get as much benefit about as antidepressants for moderate depression. Or you can supplement 5-hydroxytryptophan. The appendix in the book, my wife wrote it, want to give her a shout out, Jan Hansen, superstar. Are you listening, honey? Anyway, she bugged me about naming her another thing, as well she should. Anyway, it's a great appendix on nutritional neurochemistry, and nothing is in there without a reference, because there's a lot of hocus-pocus out there, and I was really interested in what has references. Now, there's a lot of good stuff that doesn't yet have a reference, but what's there definitely has a reference. Okay, so that would be that. The other thing is, it is interesting that as we activate, like through exercise, we're getting sympathetic activation. And the interesting point, this for me also was something that I learned from neuroscience, is that oftentimes we get pleasurable sympathetic activation, like from exercise or from getting excited about our daughter finally shooting a basket or the 49ers winning or something like that. But have you ever noticed how easy it is to go right from excitement to anger? Just like that. It's because neurologically, the circuitry that the sympathetic nervous system and its related hormones is intertwined with is really primed to go negative. So when you light it up, it's still positive, but it's ready to go negative on a hair trigger. So to me, the takeaway is not to not get excited or enthusiastic about wonderful things, but just be a little thoughtful about it. In other words, sympathetic arousal primes aversion. That's four fancy words, but that's the bottom line. Sympathetic arousal primes us, gets us ready to have an aversive reaction to something. So just notice that. You know, and I suspect there might be something like that a little happening there for you. And again, you think about practicing with it, including, honestly, regarding a fair amount of what flows through the mind as like junk mail. It's just generic, it's there, and it's not meaningful. It's a difference that makes no difference. It's not meaningful. It's not informative. It doesn't add informational value. And I think recognizing the ongoing tickle of anxiety, or sometimes feeling shaky maybe at the end of a workout, just to regard it. It is just what it is. And it doesn't mean anything. Often we make it mean something. We attribute meaning to it that it doesn't really carry. And that is a way, you know, to go forward. Okay, a couple more, then we'll, I want to talk through this a little bit, and then we'll move on. Yeah, in the back there. Great. Yes.
I was really able to sort of let go and feel that compassion for myself. I'm curious about how that will work out when I don't have someone making that suggestion.
Right. Yeah, you'll see. And great comment, you know. Often it's the case that we'll listen more to other people, especially if they're, you know, sitting in the front of a room with a microphone, right? Or a bullhorn or something like that, or they're on Fox News or whatever, you know. On the other hand, I think there's a way to play with that, which is to internalize messages from nurturing figures. Really classically, and I hope I'm not overwhelming you with, for me, really useful tools chunking around. One of them in psychology is this notion of sort of three parts to the personality. You know, one way of talking about it is the inner child, the nurturing parent, and the critical parent. Or more recent way to talk about it is the victim, the perpetrator or persecutor, and the rescuer. Right? We have those three parts. You kind of follow that? We do them. Okay. The interesting thing is that where the action very often is with the failed rescuer, the nurturing person who wasn't, or should have been but wasn't. You know. And I think a lot, we don't have internalized enough of a nurturing cluster of voices inside our head that help us soothe us, encourage us, help us rally, and fend off or filter what's useful, what's wheat, out of the chaff, the junk mail, if you will, of the internalized critic. All right? And that process of internalizing positive experiences, of being supported and guiding by people who've got your back or on your side, is a wonderful way to slowly build literally the neural structure that supports that mental experience of having an internal supporter, right? And to me, that's a really lovely and important thing to do, you know, over the course of the lifetime. And one way to do that is to imagine, you know, like what would Buddha say, right? Or what would your friends say? Or, and this constellation ranges from, you know, your grandmother who could see no wrong in you, and she was right in some ways. Or other people, I'm thinking lately of Mike Singletary, coach of the 49ers. Sorry for the football references. I don't know. But anyway, this kind of tough love coach. But that's also one of those nurturing figures. And again, internalization of teachers or wisdom traditions can be part of those nurturing figures. That's really helpful to us as we go down the long road of practice. Right? Okay, one more and then I'll talk through the slide quickly. Yeah, back there? There was someone who had his hand up back there? No? Okay, you. You look good. You'll fill a slot. It'll work.
This is going to be, a bit of a clumsy question. Hopefully I can get it out of there. Sympathetic arousal primes aversion. I'm a psychotherapist, and I'm thinking about some of my patients who, adult patients who are so fully enmeshed with the children. And they talk about coming to an event, a soccer game, or being with their kids, where they are, I mean, it's almost narcissistic. They're full, they're grandiose, they're wonderful, life is great, and as soon as it's over, they're deflated. And they talk about their depression, and some of these clients do have relationship depression. So is there an intervention? You know, because if you say sympathetic arousal primes aversion, you can't take away the arousal. I mean,
let's suppose it's wholesome arousal. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Go on.
So is there any kind of intervention in any of these practices that gives them a balance? Shows them a balance. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, wonderful. And with clients or with people in general, I've really focused a lot on parasympathetic activation. because again, it, to me, it's been one of those areas where suddenly you see something. Everybody's talked about relax, you know, peacefulness, relaxation. How many times have we heard that stuff? You know, like whatever, you know, songs, elevator music. But actually, it's incredibly important. So that's one thing I do. I really focus on skills, you know, with people around being able to mount within seconds a calming, centering kind of response. I have a, in my mind, I have kind of a little four-step process I think of as like emergency psychological first aid, right? And it's basically, you know, to just stop. That's the first one. Tara Brach, wonderful teacher, wonderful book, Radical Acceptance, says pause. Just stop, right? And then the second one is to, you know, have compassion for oneself in that moment. Like, this hurts. I'm getting upset. I'm alarmed here. And then next, get on one's own side. And often that happens in the first 3 seconds. But that's psychological first aid. And then based on pause, don't say a word. One of the best things I've ever learned to do sometimes with my family when I don't forget is shut up. How often do we make a mistake not saying something? Sometimes. How often do we make a mistake because we did say something? A fair amount. So stop, you know, compassion for oneself, get on one's own side, and then make a plan. And often that first step of the plan is to calm the body. Calm the body. Because nothing good will happen if that body's all revved up and not clear. So to me, that's one thing I would say. Yeah, a second thing, just really fast, is to just say, I find it's incredibly useful to explain the brain to people. I just wrote this piece recently called The Brain, So What? For a therapy magazine. It might get published in some form. Anyway, the point is, I think brain science adds value for me to the to Buddhist practice, but also to living in four basic ways. So I'll just name them fast. One is that it creates kind of an overarching framework whereby we can really understand things. In other words, when you hear a Tibetan practice and you hear a Vipassana practice and then you hear some positive psychology thing and then you get some advice from Oprah Winfrey or whatever, right? And then you realize even though they're using really different words, bottom line, they're talking about the same target in the brain, right? Then you appreciate that. Or, see what I mean? Or sometimes you hear people, less commonly, but still, using the same words, but clearly from the context, they're talking about very different brain states, right? They're using the same language, but it really refers to underlying different neural conditions. So it's helpful in that way. Second, it draws our attention a lot to what's already been known of the 10,000 tools, right? In the toolbox of practice, what's really useful. I said that. Also, third, it helps invent new methods. Right, occasionally. I think one of them, for example, is using internal sensing of the body to promote empathy. Another one is the first step I did, where I encourage you to mingle thoughts and feelings of compassion together. Because the anterior cingulate cortex, remember that little caterpillar lit up there in the gray side shot of the brain? Is the intersection, is ground zero for putting thinking and feeling together. And boy, do we want to do that, right? A lot of people can think and a lot of people can feel, but to bring clarity into being upset, or to take someone who's kind of like Spock and infuse Spock, you know, who's genderized this, more often male than not, with, you know, emotion in some way, that's the anterior cingulate cortex. Well, one way to, so if you are connecting emotion and feeling together by mingling thoughts and feelings of compassion together, you're strengthening a part of the brain that also is involved in executive control of attention and steadying the mind. So that's an example, I think, where brain science suggests or highlights a new method. The fourth benefit is probably the major benefit. It's motivating. Because somehow when you explain to clients, for example, that this is happening inside your body, or here we are in the cushion, which sometimes seems so fruitless, perhaps, or we're just once again, you know, dealing with someone who's wronged us, but trying to remember, what was that Buddha gorilla story, you know? To understand that, you know, every time I throw those hot coals, I'm burning my brain. You know, kind of really basic. There's something really motivating about feeling that it's in the tissue. And sidebar for all the therapists who raised their hand, I find this really works a lot with kids and adolescents. Weirdly enough, because they'll listen to it because it's about their brain. And it kind of makes sense to them. So, motivation. So I just want to, yeah, so I'm going to call out a couple more things here that are maybe not so obvious. fondness for the breath heightens stimulation, because sometimes, you know, the brain naturally enough habituates, gets used to, and starts ignoring a stimulus that has become neutral. A lot of the key to practice is to pay more and more attention to the neutral feeling tone of experience. Because as Christina Feldman once said to me, it's the doorway to the eventless. Because in the neutral, nothing's happening, right? And then you get used to nothing happening and ultimately get more comfortable with kind of the ground that it in itself nothing is happening. You know, a lot of stuff is happening out of it, but it itself is not happening. It's just eternal, okay? Another thing last is the batting away. You got to be careful about that because it's really easy to get into aversion. But if your mind has gotten quite quiet and you can start watching in a time scale of about a second, you know, it takes usually about a quarter of a second for a neural coalition to start to really bubble up into conscious awareness, another quarter of a second for it to kind of settle a little bit, another quarter of a second so it's moving from sort of jello, loose jello to firm jello, fourth final quarter of a second, it's kind of turned into cement, right? Or maybe the first 2 seconds. Anyway, early on, if you're watching it, and you can when your mind's quite quiet, just sort of bat it away, gently. And people might even verbalize it, or you know, like, no, not now, later, I'm good. I think that's kind of cool to interrupt these neural coalitions because when they're forming, they're unstable, and we can just bat it away. Okay, so those are examples. Now, normally you wouldn't get my voice on tape and every minute or so get a new instruction. You would just find the instructions that really work for you, or notice that, you know, maybe when you're trying to steady the mind, even in a business meeting, right? Real life. Or pay attention to a fairly boring story that your aunt is telling you again, right? Or your spouse. Won't go there. But anyway, trying to help yourself stay there with it, you can play around with some of these methods on the fly, and certainly in contemplative practice, to see what works for you. I find when that really works for me and that I was surprised about. And yet it's very consistent with the Dharma, and it's the one we'll do next. And then after which, I think we'll take a break and then we'll do another method, is positive feeling. I remember this line from Eugene Cash on a concentration retreat where he said, I realized that all I had to do was be devoted to the breath and let go of everything else. And I knew what to do then. Right, breath after breath after breath. A kind of warm-heartedness. A sort of fondness. Did anybody notice that when you just played around with feeling warmer or fonder toward the breath, that it kind of helped you stay with it? You're nodding. Other people are nodding as well. That's something to explore, too. All right? You want to try another round? You okay with this? All right. So now, let's go after when my yoga teacher told me to watch out for the bliss. So I want to... let's see here. Create a little bit of a frame here. So first off, when people are attempting to awaken, cultivate positive emotion, sometimes they run up against a frustration because maybe they're just really tired or honestly, they're depressed for whatever reason. They're just, it's not going to ignite. What I mean to say is, not being able to access positive emotion for those reasons or any other reason is okay. Try to not add to the negative emotion by getting mad at yourself or me for trying to encourage you in this direction. That said, I will encourage you in this direction. And what you may find is that you actually bypass bliss and or even happiness, strong happiness, but you can relate to contentment and even tranquility. So see what works for you. I will talk here about 4 states. I'll use the word bliss or rapture, and then happiness, contentment, and tranquility. And just to name the differences again, rapture, bliss, the Pali term for that is piti, is a sense of real engagement with the object of attention, but also waves of energy that are very pleasurable in the body. Some of those waves of energy come, you know, like just kind of briefly, and some of them just sustain. And also sometimes one senses a kind of bliss nibbling around the edges that hasn't quite fully moved in. And that's okay too. Just see what you can get a feeling for here. All right? I don't know if it's officially okay to do it. I do it, so I'm going to mention it. Sometimes I find that basically the way it works is to really focus, do muscular, sustained, highly intended absorption in the breath, at least for a few minutes, if not 15, 20 minutes straight. We won't do 15, 20 minutes just to, you know, have more of a buffet here than a single course meal. But to kind of muscularly go into the breath, and it almost charges the battery. So then when you open up and say, may rapture arise, or if you want to use the traditional word, may piti arise, then it almost bubbles up more. Another thing is, when you get to the point of kind of opening up to rapture, it works for me, I inhale more. I kind of quicken the breath. I find myself, maybe it's a yogic technique I've just stumbled on that's been known for centuries, it probably has been. I'm just kind of tightening the muscles of my spine, almost pulsing, the kundalini or whatever, of my spine. I don't know. I'm trying to ignite a state of mind. I'm trying to help, you know, like water, when you heat it up to boil, it heats up and it starts kind of quivering on its surface, and it quivers, tips into a rolling boil. That's a state shift. We're trying to get a neural state shift that maps to a mental state shift of bliss. Whoa, that's really pleasurable. Okay? And by any means necessary, as long as we don't get too attached to it. Then happiness. Happiness is happiness. I think about my kids. That makes me happy. So right now, you might want to think about what are some of the things that very reliably make you happy when you bring them to awareness. Bring a person to mind. People often will talk about a pet, kids, Tuolumne Meadows. You know, suddenly I'm happy. Obama winning, I'm happy. Stuff like that, 49ers, yeah, whatever. Sorry, I just had to do that. Okay, so what makes you happy? Happiness is happiness, just kind of ordinary meaning of it. Contentment is that milder version, yet in a way almost more desirable, where everything's really okay and you feel good. Okay, it's not just neutral, it's affectively positive. It's got a lot of pleasant feeling tone, hedonic tone in it, but it's, you know, everything's kind of accepted. And then tranquility, the mind is very, very quiet and peaceful. Whoa, what a relief. It's interesting that as you progress down this path, the movement from the previous state into something that's actually less intense but more pervasive often feels like a relief. Like it's a relief to move from rapture to happiness, from happiness to contentment, contentment to tranquility. Okay, you might notice something of that. And then at the end of the meditation, we'll come back out again, tracking each discrete state, partly to form a very clear sense memory of what each state is like, so you can find your way back again. I mean, that's a lot of what practice is about, learning to access certain very wholesome states of mind, which map to wholesome states of brain, if you will, and then to be able skillfully to kind of tee them up. Genuinely, I've become able to become really quite happy at will, which is pretty good, you know, it feels good, you know, and hopefully if Bertrand Russell is right, you know, being a happy person helps make me a gooder person. So, okay, so let's play around with this, all right, and do kind of an experiment here. So find a comfortable position. And as I said, we're going to aim here for some, you know, deep end of the pool states of mind. And one thing to invite you to is let yourself have non-ordinary states of awareness, if only for a few seconds. Kind of allow that to happen. It's all right. We're in a nice, safe setting. Please don't get up and jump around. I feel joy. It'll be distracting. But otherwise, let yourself feel as good as you possibly can. All right. So settle into yourself. Relax. Don't try to control the breath in any way. Let it be what it is. Let the body do the breathing. be aware of the internal sensations of breathing. The cool air going in, the warm air flowing out. So we'll follow each breath for the next 5 minutes. So form an intention, perhaps with words, perhaps an embodied sense of being, a practiced deep meditator who can tip into each breath from beginning to end for the next 5 minutes using whatever methods you like. Some we may have covered, or no methods at all, to simply be present to the sensations of breathing felt at some part of your body or in your body altogether for the next 5 minutes. staying grounded in the breath, let your attention widen a bit to the body as a whole and see if there are any whispers or pulses or waves of rapture or bliss. If there are not, return attention to absorption in the breath. But if there is a sense of some rapture, some bliss coming in, knocking on the door, open to it, invite it, encourage it, may rapture arise. Explore this. Perhaps breathe a little faster. Allow rushes of pleasure, of energy, of bliss to move through your body, if they do. But if you can tell that it just won't happen yet, go back to absorption in the breath and then shift back to an invitation for rapture after a minute or two. As you can, intensify any feelings of bliss in the body. Even little quick pulses of pleasure in your body. May rapture arise. If it happens that a blissful feeling becomes steady, let it become the new object of absorption and fall into, become more deeply involved with, feelings of bliss. But if rapture fades, it's fine to go back to the breath for a few minutes and then back to rapture again. whatever you've been experiencing is fine. And now I'll shift more toward happiness. May happiness arise. Invite it in, open to it, gently encourage it as you can, perhaps by thinking of something that makes you feel happy, or move toward happiness directly as a state of mind. Perhaps smile a bit, feeling happiness in your body. There's no need to force it, and if it doesn't come, it doesn't. You can always go back to the breath. But as you can, allow yourself to be as full of happiness as possible. And if it does stabilize, you can let it become the new object of concentration. Saturating your mind with happiness. May happiness arise. Whatever you've been experiencing is fine. And now I'll shift from happiness to contentment. And again, feel free to go your own way with these suggestions and do what feels right to you. Contentment is a pleasant feeling of well-being, with no wish for the moment to be anything other than what it is. May contentment arise. Allow yourself, as it occurs for you, to be pervaded by contentment. A very pleasant feeling. No reaching for pleasure, no resisting of pain. Relaxed and happy in this moment as it is. letting go of discontent, becoming increasingly absorbed in the experience of contentment itself. Whatever you've been experiencing is fine, and I'll shift at this point to tranquility, which you may already have become rested in. Tranquility, a deeply, deeply peaceful and quiet state of mind, like a pond that is perfectly still. May tranquility arise. And as you can, letting yourself become increasingly absorbed in a great stillness, a great peace, and let it become the new object of absorption. whatever you've been experiencing is fine. And now slowly, over the next several minutes, let yourself gently come back out of this meditation, moving at your own pace from tranquility as you can to contentment, to happiness, to bliss, and then to a resting in the breath over the next 3 minutes. So I encourage you to see if you can stay with whatever is there for you or gained for you from the practice you did. And in a moment, we'll take a brief break as much as possible in silence. It's okay if you need to chat a little bit with someone. I'll hang out here and, you know, talk with people if you like. But as much as you can, stay quiet. And as much as you can, I encourage you sort of watch moment to moment what promotes staying in touch with a sense of tranquility. or perhaps contentment, or what helps refresh or regenerate, refuel tranquility or contentment. Okay, so, and if you're inclined and you haven't yet done so to offer some generosity for Inside LA, this would be a good time to do it. And let's come back in let's come back in 15 quiet minutes.
Rick and I talked about that the offerings for Inside LA will go to support people who want to attend our programs and who are either out of work or just down on their luck.